Whether or not it's the music that finds certain people, or certain people who find the music, what is clear is that for many, music is transformative. It's a vessel, it's a vehicle, a drug, an antidote, an obsession, and a salvation. And as the music moves through us, we are also moved through the music. Emotionally, sure. And often in very significant ways, physically too. Welcome to The Third Story, I'm Leo Sidran. Today's episode is a special one. As I close out the season, I'm bringing together two compelling conversations that I had earlier this year with pianists Aaron Parks and Marta Sanchez. These are two incredible musicians with totally distinct stories, but whose stories complement one another in surprising and beautiful ways. Together, I think they offer an exploration of the transformative power of music and the ways in which it can help to navigate the complexities of life, while at the same time creating its own set of challenges, especially for those who devote their lives to making it. As I look back on both of these conversations, I'm reminded why I started this podcast in the first place, to explore the stories behind the music and to connect with the people who make it. This episode feels like a fitting way to end the year, not just because of the richness of Aaron's and Marta's stories, but because of the themes they touch on: growth, resilience, and the transformative power of music. The other night, I got a WhatsApp message from my friend Alix in Girona, Spain. He runs a fantastic club called The Sunset. Alix told me that Aaron Parks had just played a solo performance at his club, and it was spectacular. And then he suggested that I should talk to Aaron for the podcast, because he seems to be in such a creative and vibrant moment right now. What Alix didn't know is that I had already planned to share this conversation this week. I thought to myself, sometimes the stars just align in the right way. Some things are bigger than us, or out of our control. It was a small thing, just a little coincidence. But sometimes even the littlest things can resonate as big. It's a fitting thought for a conversation with Aaron Parks, who recently released Little Big 3 on Blue Note Records. This is actually the second time I've talked to Aaron for the podcast. The first time was in 2019, just before the COVID pandemic. And you can hear that conversation in the archive at third-story.com or in your favorite podcast app or on YouTube. It's episode 119. But since we first talked, a lot has changed for him, personally, professionally, kind of in every way. For this conversation, we spoke at Winter Jazz Fest in early 2024. It was January, in fact, and Aaron was on the cusp of a major life transition. He was preparing to leave New York and move to Portugal, seeking a different pace and a new kind of inspiration. In our talk, he was very open, talked about his journey, including his struggles with mental health challenges and how they shaped his music and his approach to leading a band. He also spoke very candidly about the challenges he faced in becoming a new father during the pandemic. It's a deep one. So here's the first of two conversations in today's episode, me and Aaron Parks talking it down last winter at the Moxie Hotel. Aaron Parks, you just rolled in with your luggage, backpack on your back. You played last night a little big performance at Winter Jazz Festival. Tonight you're playing with Terry Lynn Carrington. Yeah. Tomorrow a solo show.
Yeah.
And I have it on good authority that these are some of your final days in the country.
That's correct. These are the final three shows before my family up and leaves for Lisbon. We just packed up our place up in Beacon. We were living up there for since the pandemic, and we packed up the house somehow. I don't really completely understand how that happened.
Yeah.
I also don't understand how you can accumulate so much stuff. Living in apartments in Brooklyn for many, many years, I got used to not having a lot of space. And then when we moved up to Beacon, you got space and have
a way
of just getting filled.
Yeah, so. I know that feeling. I think that the process of disruption on every level is positive.
I agree.
I say that as somebody who is very hesitant to do it personally, but I recognize it. And I'm so envious of people that are prepared to disrupt creatively, personally, all of that
stuff. It's a lot. It's a lot, but I don't know. It's the kind of thing where, you know, I just turned 40.
Yeah.
And it would be very easy to just sort of like settle in, you know, been doing this for a while, sort of just keep on doing it, just the way that we've been. And like, you get to New York and you just sort of, that's where you live for the rest of your life. It's a very easy thing to do. And there's a lot that I love about this city and especially about the people here. But there is something, I've always been curious about just living somewhere else, just being in a different culture, having to learn a new language. And having a kid, it just puts things into different perspective, not to mention financially, paying for education and healthcare and all this kind of stuff. Like sort of the idea of Europe and a social safety net that actually makes it, for an artist, it feels here in the States, it really just feels like such an uphill battle a lot of the time, just constantly running your wheels just to sort of barely stay afloat. I don't expect that Portugal is going to have all the answers, but I'm definitely curious to give it another shot. My wife lived in Europe for 10 years before we were together.
So you met your wife overseas when she was in Italy? Is that
That's
where
right.
she was?
She was part of the production team at a festival in Modena in Italy, and when I was on tour with Kurt Rosenwinkel's band there. We just met one night and had great conversations. We hung out late until the night. She was actually married at the time, but we just hit it off as friends. The marriage that she was in didn't end up working out for her, so she left that. She was living in Europe for many years. She's originally from Colombia.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, my son Lucas is already bilingual yeah. and then soon to be trilingual.
Yes.
So he's got a couple legs up on me, this stupid monolingual American.
Well, you speak languages that don't have words, but
well,
do have
that,
grammar.
Yeah, okay, there is that.
I imagine New York when you were young. We talked about this last time we talked. You started playing very young. New York must have represented making it the top of the mountain.
That's right.
For a time.
Yep.
So I think it really is a rite of passage for you to say, I don't need to be here anymore. When I could imagine as a young teenager, all you wanted to do was get to New York.
Totally. And right now it does feel like New York is always here. It always changes, but it's never going to stop being New
yes.
York. I think every generation, including mine, has the tendency to be like, oh, but it's not what it was. And that's true.
Yes.
It is not what it was, but it is what it is.
Yes.
And that's something new. We lose some things and we gain some things.
Yes.
For me, I'm really glad that I spent as much time here as I did.
Yeah.
I do think that there is a little bit of a process of something about New York that if you're not careful can have a sort of heart-hardening effect where just to sort of survive and mm-hmm. cope with just, I mean, even just the utter weirdness that you see on a daily
sure.
subway commute, not to mention just people laid out in the street. And to not have your heart completely feeling broken all the time, it's very easy to sort of develop this psychic shield, I guess, around yourself that prevents you from really feeling any of this stuff as fully as we probably should. You know, and already living in Beacon,
yeah.
it felt like we broke the gravitational pull of the five boroughs.
Yeah.
And so we already reached escape velocity. So I already wasn't living in New York.
Yes. Did you notice it have any impact on your musical life or your creative brain?
Living upstate?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I feel like there was, there's different phases of it. There was the early pandemic
yes.
period of living up there where I was just sort of coming to terms with being a dad and also sort of losing my identity as a musician because there were no gigs and I sort of had lost focus, I guess, musically. Just wasn't really playing a lot of piano or writing much at the very beginning.
Yeah.
And simultaneously having the new identity as father, something that I was stepping into, but I think a lot of men don't necessarily talk about how disorienting it can be at first. Like, I was excited to be a dad on paper, but it was also really hard. It was really hard, and it wasn't like the most immediate, natural sort of like, oh yeah, I've got this amazing bond with my son. It took time.
Yeah.
You know, at first it was like, rather than, you know, you feel like, oh, he's the most important thing in the world to me. But I'm just like, I think I want to keep you safe. I think I like you, but I don't know you. You're this dude who's in my house now.
Well, they're not even really finished cooking.
They're not finished cooking
yeah.
for the first 3 months, exactly.
So how do you bond with something that is still so totally in development?
But it took a little while. But I was actually really grateful ultimately to sort of be honest with myself about the fact that didn't come so easily at first. Although it was sort of hard to acknowledge to myself. But then when that bond with me and my son did develop, it really felt not like going through the motions. It didn't feel like doing something because I had to do it. It just felt like, yeah, here's this thing that has arisen naturally.
Yeah. I found also, I have now a 12-year-old daughter, but I also found that my daughter anyway, really needed my wife more than me and
right.
wanted my wife more than
of
me.
Of course.
And so you become this sort of satellite, this appendage that is like there, but in trying to be useful. But so it makes it that much harder to develop that bond also.
So I guess those early days in Beacon, it was disorienting, like losing my identity as a musician and then having this identity as a father that I didn't really understand.
Was it difficult to be, I mean, this is not only about you, but maybe anybody who was a parent of a newborn in the early days of the pandemic. You know, when we bring children into the world, we have to ask ourselves, do we want to bring a child into this world at this moment? And
yep.
there could be no louder message than the pandemic to bring that into focus.
It was a bit of a mixed thing. There was definitely, you know, just the fear and the suffering and the tremendous loss that we were all experiencing at that time. Loss in a lot of different ways. Loss in terms of death, but also loss of what we imagined the future to be. Loss of what we thought was coming next. And I think, honestly, you know, like you were mentioning earlier, that disruption can really be a good thing. I do think that disruption is a very useful tool, and we better get used to it, because I feel like there's a lot more disruption coming down the line in the coming decades.
Yeah.
The more that we can figure out how to roll with those things and adapt is going to be the better. So to follow through with my thought, there was that. And there was also a feeling of, you know, because it felt like the world stopped, this feeling of being in a cocoon with my family. Mm-hmm. And actually, and even though it was not the most easy first 6 to 12 months for me as a new father, me not having gigs to go off to, me just sort of being like sitting with that feeling. And sitting with that discomfort, and also just being having the time to be present for this crazy transition, where, I mean, I think part of the thing that was also really hard for me, if I'm being really honest about it, is just I like to think of myself as not a particularly egocentric person, but I don't think that that's necessarily that true. I think that there are elements within me, as has the potential within any person, and especially artists, to be just a bit self-absorbed. Having a child changing the viewpoint from the me to the we.
I think the reality, you talk about things that don't get talked about, is that for many artists, they never fully make that transition.
Right.
It is too great a loss.
Right.
Particularly when you've started so young, your relationship with youth is very tied up with your own experience.
That's interesting.
And you certainly wouldn't be the first to experience that sense of loss and the struggle of how do I become selfless when basically my job and my life until now has been to search the self and make something of it.
That's right. And ultimately, I feel like the answer has come from realizing that we is not a negation of me. We is not disappearing the self, but it's integrating others and expanding the sense of, so not negating my own needs and my own, because you're exactly right. And I think that that's part of what was going wrong for me in the early days. As I was trying to step into the idea of what I thought fatherhood was, I was sacrificing myself completely, throwing myself away as I was trying to do the right thing.
And if I remember, your family was very committed to your development as a kid, right? And so if your vision of what parenthood is that there's a kind of a sacrifice of the self in for the need of the child.
Yep.
Which we do, obviously.
That's true. And just in general, it's always a bit of an and, not an or.
Yeah, right?
But I'm really grateful to, you know, to have the opportunity to learn all of these things. And also I'm incredibly grateful. My wife, Maria, is very wise and very patient. I learn just so much from her in a wide variety of ways. I'm a lucky guy and I know it.
In terms of setting up your career from abroad, we know other musicians of your sort of crew and generation who have moved abroad. And some of them were European and moved back home. Mm-hmm. Others have spent time abroad, whatever. Is there a sense that because, just in economic terms, the money gets made on the road, that it doesn't really matter where you're coming from?
That's a big part of it, I think. So much of the money in economic terms, and so much of it is coming from Europe.
Yes.
Honestly, that's where I make my living for the most part. And so being closer to that, and, you know, Portugal, I really like for the location. It's not a long flight to get back here to
that's
the East Coast. It's close to the rest of Europe, but it's kind of on the periphery. And it's also like the thing that I love is, you know, if you look sort of east and north, you've got all of Europe.
Yeah.
You look east and south, you have Africa.
Yes.
And being at that sort of crossroads, mm-hmm. I really have a feeling that there is such interesting stuff happening in Africa right now, musically and culturally. And I really think that it's going to be increasingly important. And like just the global south in general is... Yeah, just if I were a betting man,
yes.
which I am not, but it's the time for the global south.
And you're married to a woman from Colombia, so maybe that's part of your thinking.
So, some of the way that some folk in spiritual circles talk about things is the global north is kind of the mind of the planet. The global south is kind of the heart of the planet. And we've seen what leading with only the mind has gotten us to. We need some heart,
yes,
a bit more heart, to emerge and sort of have a chance to take the reins.
That's
that
beautiful
to me.
That's really beautiful.
Are we need to tune?
So I asked you before we talked if there was anything you wanted me to listen to or know about that's coming up, and you sent me an album, essentially, from Bandcamp that I was not aware of, and subsequently I see that you've talked about it a little bit already, and it's in keeping with something that you've done in the past also.
Sure.
It's not just a bootleg in the sense that the sound person gave you a hi-fi recording of a gig that you thought, this sounds good enough that it could be sound like an album.
Right.
It's not even like somebody put a high-quality stereo recorder in the room.
Not at all.
It's an iPhone recording.
That's right.
Of a gig that you played in Germany.
That's right.
So what is it about that experience that you like sharing?
I don't know, man. I've gotten used to the sound of it. I probably should get another audio device, but I don't remember to bring them with me.
Yep.
When I do use them, I don't remember to listen to them. There's something about the casual nature of it, and it's just, and I've gotten used to the sound quality of it.
Yeah.
There's something about the way that it compresses the piano sound in particular. I record almost every gig that I play.
Yeah. And do you listen?
I listen back to not everything, but I listen back to a lot of things, just, you know, trying to understand better, like, how things actually sound as opposed to how I thought they sound.
Yeah. Or how they felt.
How they felt, yeah. And trying to be, because so many of the times it's actually quite different than how it was perceived in the moment. It's good for sort of, doing reconnaissance on yourself. Yeah. I've found it very, very useful in that regard. Sometimes I come across things. You know, we get lucky and you capture something that feels like a real moment where things were just clicking. And that's what that night was. It was the fourth gig of a tour with what ended up becoming the new lineup of the band with a new drummer,
Jungkook Kim. I really like his playing a lot.
He's very special. Yeah. He's very special. I mean, so is Tommy Crane. It's a really...
Yes, embarrassment of riches.
The band, we've been very lucky to have really interesting, innovative, creative drummers doing cool stuff. So that was our fourth gig as a band, and it was the first gig where everything really started to just click.
Yeah.
There was something about it that a handful of the tunes, I was just like, you know what? I like listening to this. I bet other people might like listening to this too.
Well, that's the interesting thing about putting out a gig when it's not about fidelity or the technical conditions around it. It's not like there was a video or something. You know, that's one way of doing it. That's number four out of how many gigs were on that tour?
There were five gigs.
Right.
You know? Yeah.
So, but it wasn't the fifth one and it wasn't the third one. There was something about the fourth one where you said, this is the one. If I'm going to put one of these out, this would be the one.
It just had, a certain unforced magic.
Yeah.
And like plenty of mistakes. You know, like I'm playing wrong notes.
Are there such things as wrong notes?
I know, right? Well, definitely I'm playing the notes that weren't written on the page. Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm screwing up my own melodies plenty of times. But we were all feeling so good. And it just felt like the band really doing what the band... The studio records, I like them a lot.
Yeah.
I still have a lot of fondness for them.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something about those first two records which does feel a little bit... like at a distance,
yes.
like more pristine, then I really feel like the band, like there's a rawness and a sort of sloppiness to the band that we hadn't completely captured yet.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I'm very excited about, we just were in the studio.
You alluded that something's going on, so I was wondering.
Yeah, we just, yeah. So putting out that record with Alive in Japan, I put it out as like a free download.
Yeah.
This one I put out as a, you know, pay me something.
Yeah.
Which is sort of a little bit ironic in a funny way, because I was thinking about last year and the things that I put out. There was a solo piano series of videos that yeah. I recorded in Lisbon, and I put them out on my YouTube page, didn't yeah. charge anything for them, yeah. spent money mixing, mastering, getting a video crew and everything,
wow.
and they're up for free. And then the iPhone bootleg is what I'm charging
for. You charge.
So go figure.
Anything goes. No, I mean, that's what I feel too. Like, I think whether or not it's your intention, there is a slightly provocative question that is being asked when you put that out, which is, well, what is a record? And at what point should there be a transaction? Because
right.
we do give so much away.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all artists today on some level are, I saw you yesterday or 2 days ago on your Instagram, just practicing,
yeah.
just improvising.
Yeah.
You gave away an improvisation. You right. gave away a performance.
Yeah.
Which is part of, in a way, the expectation of everybody is that you have to sort of give something,
right.
and share your process and all that. And so at some point, when do you charge for something?
I don't know. And I don't know the answer for that. Yeah. I don't like it.
Yeah.
I'm not a fan of this system that we've built for ourselves
yeah.
of capitalism. And I think we could sure do a lot better if we figured out other ways of organizing ourselves. But it's what we got right now.
Yeah.
And in order for me to continue to do things
yeah.
that hopefully people like,
yeah.
I've got to charge.
Yeah.
And the thing that's been really interesting is, you know, I set the price. I'm like, I thought a lot about, like, how yeah. much am I going to charge for this little bootleg, you know? I could charge $3. That would feel really cheap and like sort of petty. If I charge $7, that yeah. feels like, oh, that, yeah. oh, you think it's a real album?
Yeah.
But like $5, that's a cup of like fancy coffee.
Do you
like,
know what's crazy, man? This bottle of water that I bought at the cafe over here at
yeah.
the Moxie Hotel cost me $6.
Totally. Exactly.
It's like, is it too much to charge $7 for a piece of music?
I know. And
but I know why you say that.
Exactly. So, but I decided to do this like as a little bit of an experiment
yeah.
of what happens if I set the price low,
yeah.
but let people know that they can pay what they want,
yeah.
because it's all going towards helping to fund pre-production and studio costs.
Yes.
And I'd say at least half of the people gave more.
Yeah.
You know, which was just, it was really encouraging and really beautiful. And it helped. It helped because the way that we went about getting ready for this record, it was not cheap because we wanted to do it right.
Yeah.
We did a residency at Shapeshifter Lab
uh-huh.
in Brooklyn
yeah.
at their new space. We were at Shapeshifter for 2 days, like full day rehearsals.
Yeah.
Of this new music that we were going to record for the record, which one of the things that I'm really excited about on this next record is that it's not only my tunes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a band. It has my name on the top, but mm-hmm. it's a band. And then after that, we booked 3.5 days up at Dreamland Recording Studios.
I saw it looked beautiful.
It's incredible up there, yeah. man. And we had really, really special time. The record's probably coming out in autumn. And I just don't know if I'm allowed to say what label it's on yet.
But I saw a picture of who was standing next to you.
Exactly. So he's producing it and he...
Can I say his name?
Don
so
Was.
Don Was is standing next to you, which for most people who are paying attention would give you a sense of what label it's on.
That's right.
Which is very exciting.
Yeah, it's. I'm very excited to be returning there
yeah.
after, you know, my first record that came out when I had no idea how to lead a band. You know, I was 24.
Yeah.
No clue what I was doing. I could make a decent record,
yeah.
but I didn't know how to keep a group of people together, and I didn't know how to sort of do the thing live, and I just wasn't mature enough.
Let's speak about it quickly now.
Sure.
Looking back on that, what that means to keep a band together and to be a band leader.
Well,
and how it differs from playing the music.
I think more than anything, it's if I'm being 100% honest, I think that it more than anything had to do with just my mental health at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I was not in a good way around the time that record came out. I had had my first sort of bipolar manic episode, which was basically... After recording the record and before it came out in May of 2008,
mm-hmm.
I had pretty much a psychotic break with reality that spurred on by a number of different things, a heartbreak, too much smoking weed.
Mm-hmm.
Weed, which turns out to be really, for many people, is not a very dangerous drug, but for people with bipolar disorder, it can be really, really problematic. And it sent me into a prolonged state of delusion. And I basically was living in an alternate world for close to a year and a half. So part of why I couldn't keep a band together was because I wasn't existing in the real world.
Yeah.
And looking back on that now, it's the kind of thing where I look back and I could feel shame, or I could feel sort of embarrassment or sadness about lost time on like what could have been. But I'm like, there were things that I did in that time that I deeply regret, and actions that I took, and just things that didn't go as I wish that they had. And it was a weird, wild adventure that I was on for a while there, even if it led to then a prolonged period of deep depression afterwards. So in a certain way, it was like a weird roller coaster ride that I went on that showed me a lot of things about just how strange and confusing and beautiful and other the world can be.
You had another manic break more recently.
Yeah.
And you were supported deeply by your band the next time around. So if you take the example from 2008 where you had a break and you didn't have people around you or didn't know how to necessarily be in an environment where you could be have people looking at you and going, man,
yep,
we got let us help support you. You had an experience last year on the road.
Last year on the road, 2022 on the road. And in particular, I'll tell you what, I was very lucky more than anything that I had Greg Tuohy with me.
Yeah.
Because on that particular tour, it was Greg Tuohy, but two new members of the band that I was, you know, friends of mine, but people who I hadn't been out on the road with that much.
Yeah.
The way I was acting was pretty bewildering. And Greg had been with me enough to see different things over the years, and that's my main man. He really helped to steer the ship. I mean, and as I said, like Little Big has become a band, and he's really my co-pilot now.
Do you think that came into focus for you after that experience, saying, oh, we're a band?
For sure. I think it was already headed in that direction in a certain way, but this iteration that we have with this crew, to me, not only feels like the closest to the marriage of the two things that I've ever got, like, you know, the structure and the songwriting and the non-jazz influences that are very important to me, combined with a fearlessness and a willingness to be comfortable with so-called mistakes.
Wrong notes. Yeah.
And just a sort of a raw energy and band chemistry. It feels like it all came together in a really, really special way on this new recording. And so what I was going to say is it feels not only like maybe my favorite thing of my own that I've ever done, but honestly, like the way that I feel about it is not that it's my favorite record of mine, but it's one of the favorite things that I've been a part of. It feels like that making this record was not making my record, was making something that I was a part of.
Yeah.
Which was, and having Don there, having the whole band, having everybody feeling really invested in this project, and being able, like, to take the time to sink into this, like, you know, be in the studio for a while, take the time we needed to make the record. The usual sort of jazz recording session thing of one rehearsal and then like a day in the studio. Yeah. It's just not going to cut it for what we were after. So I'm very excited about this record, I have to say. And that'll be out in the autumn of next year, of this year.
Of this year. The future is now, Aaron Parks.
The future is now. Wow. God damn.
Thank you so much for going in hard and fast on this one. This is, and I really feel it's a privilege to get to talk to you in this moment of transition in your life.
Man. Thank you, brother. It's always a pleasure to speak to you.
I first became aware of Marta Sanchez when she was still living in Spain and I was traveling back and forth. Years later, I was pleasantly surprised to discover that she had established herself now in New York and played often around the corner from me in Brooklyn. For a period of about a year, my young daughter and I would spend Friday early evenings listening to Marta play at Barbès, the club around the corner. She still continues to play at Barbès from time to time, but Marta doesn't play there so much anymore because she's gotten busier and more in demand. And anyway, my daughter's not so young anymore either, and she prefers not to hang out in jazz clubs with me. It's not so easy to tempt her with the promise of a Shirley Temple like it used to be. But for a time, Marta's playing was part of the soundtrack of our lives. Fast forward to this year, Marta released her remarkable album Perpetual Void, a deeply personal project inspired by her struggles with insomnia, anxiety, and depression, and which walks the intriguing line between chaos and control, composition and improvisation. Marta's always been incredibly honest about the connection between her life experiences and her music. She tells me she doesn't believe that real, deep beauty can exist if it doesn't in some small way contain its opposite as well. She told me, "I feel like you need both sides. They complement each other. And to get deep into something, you have to get deep into the other side of it too." We recorded this conversation earlier this year, and Marta opened up about her journey from Madrid to New York, the challenges and inspirations of creating a new life in a new city, and how those experiences shaped her as both an artist and a person. Marta.
I realize I don't think I've ever tried to say your name in an American accent before because I always like to speak to you in Spanish. We always speak in Spanish. So, Marta Sanchez.
You can say also my name. Without the accent.
Marta Sanchez.
Yes.
Was it a strange transition for you when you started to hear your name in an American way? Do you think that there are two people? Is there Marta and Marta?
For sure, I think, I don't know, maybe you had the same experience, mm-hmm. but I feel like you are a different person when you exist in another language. Or your ability to communicate is not the same like yes. in both languages, you know, and then you develop another way to communicate, you know, and you became a little bit a different person. You know?
I think so. What I realized about that when I became my Spanish self was that we don't really even fully know how many people we are until we have that opportunity.
Yeah.
Because I discovered a different part of myself.
Totally. For me, it was fascinating. And yeah. I always tell everybody, it's like unbelievable because you become another person. Yeah. You are like two different people. And when I come back to Madrid and I speak with my friends, I'm yeah. like my old self.
For some reason, I thought that we met in Spain. But I don't know if I met you in Spain or if I met you here.
I don't think so. I think maybe, I mean, you were like, you with your, with Ben, yeah. you were like, I saw your name many times, yeah. mostly playing at Café Central. And yeah. probably I want to see you guys play, you know. But I don't think we really meet, yeah. you know.
Until here.
Until here.
Maybe I saw your name in Madrid also. And that's why I was so surprised and happy when I discovered that you played in my neighborhood. And when my daughter was little, we used to come see you play all the yes. time. But I guess I don't really know, and if you don't mind just telling the story, how it started for you before you came to New York, like
in Spain.
In Spain, what your early life was, like I learned that you are a twin?
Yes, I am a twin. Yes, I'm a twin and I have another sister and I play piano since I was like 7, like just classical music. I actually was interested in other things. I kind of like love music. I remember my teacher once say, you know, you're going to be a musician. And I was like, no, I don't want to. He was like, yeah, you want to. Your sisters are not, but you are going to be a musician. Because
did your sisters take piano lessons or music lessons also?
Yes, we were all taking lessons, but actually they quit.
But the teacher recognized something about
yeah,
you.
Yeah, when we were kids or early teenagers, I think. He saw it, yeah, because he saw, like, I like it in a way, or, you know, I felt it in a way that they didn't.
Did your parents
play music? Were they musical?
No, not at all. My father was so much into culture, you know, and he was like an avid reader. Mm. I read a lot. I feel like influenced by him. Mm-hmm. And he was interested in all kinds of culture, but no music, you know. And my mom loved music, but it was mostly classical music.
So. But so for your parents to put you and your sisters in a music classes, it was just part of a well-rounded
childhood? I guess. My mom said that I ask for, or we ask for piano lessons. I mean, it could be. I think my mom wanted us to have the most, you know, round education. Yeah. You know.
And your twin sister is a scientist?
Yes, she's an astrophysicist.
It's big. It's a big word, an astrophysicist.
I mean, it's a big thing, I guess.
But so a smart a family that valued education and thinking and reading.
Yeah, they I think my mom, she wanted us not be dependent on anybody, you know. Uh-huh. She was very feminist and whatever, and she, you know, she wanted us to have like power over our lives.
You had a number of factors that were unusual in your story. When you came to the States, you came from Spain, you were a woman. Those are two big ones, I guess, you know. I mean, there are not so many musicians from Spain living in New York.
Yeah, very little, yeah.
And then among that very small group, very few of them are women.
Yeah.
Is it the same in Spain? When you were in your classical musical development, was it equal between men and women?
Well, I feel in the classical world, it's a little bit different, you know, because there are way more women, because I guess it's like more, there are more role models. It's like more traditional, the woman like playing classical piano, right? It's more normal. But then when I start playing jazz, because I start playing jazz in Spain, right? Yeah. I was basically the only woman instrument. Like, there was like one more woman, like a trombone player, Cheryl Waters. I don't know if you remember Cheryl. Other than that, I was the only one. And she wasn't like in the jam sessions and everything. So most of the time I was like a super young woman in the jam sessions. Mm-hmm. I'm in Madrid, that you know how it is. They start at 1 or 2, you know, and they go until 5 a.m. I will run a jam session 3 days a week, a bogey that will finish like at 4 a.m. or something, like 3 days a week, you know.
You ran a jam session 3 days a week at Bogey?
Yeah, I was the only woman there playing, you know, the only one in the jazz scene with everything that you can imagine.
Did you feel safe among those musicians?
I always felt safe. Also, my personality, and mostly back in the day, you know, it was like very, very tough. Strong, and I will deal with anybody, you know. It was easy for me to deal with anybody, and it never really affected me in that sense, you know. I feel like other women, I talk with them and they were like, oh yeah, I stopped playing. I know that environment can be really bad for other people. For me, it wasn't that bad because I was good dealing with everybody, but still, for me, it was the only thing that I knew, you know. But I wonder how would have been if I developed in an environment with other women, more like feeling like you are not defending yourself or anything.
Right. And then from the point of view of playing jazz piano in Spain, did you feel that you should be paying attention to the innovators of Spanish jazz piano? Were the people developing the language of Spanish music and jazz important to you, or were you looking already outside of Spain in your playing?
I think I was already looking outside of Spain because, you know, I never play flamenco. Flamenco, we never like listen to flamenco at home. We are not gypsy and whatever, and I always like had so much respect for flamenco, and I didn't want to just take a little bit of flavor without getting deep into flamenco just because I'm from Spain. It didn't feel like it was it doesn't feel still that it's not my music. I love flamenco, but I have a lot of respect for flamenco, and I don't feel like I will feel like an appropriation, like I'm like taking advantage of it instead of like something that comes from me, you know, from myself.
So what was your career like when you left? Where were you?
It actually was in a good place, you know. It was really racing, and I was like playing some festivals in Spain, you know, and it was going well, getting attention and good press.
What did your parents think about you becoming a musician?
They always were super supportive with. I mean, my dad died when I was 16. I actually started putting myself more into music after he died. Yeah. I guess it was like a place I could be in my room, like practicing by myself. Mm-hmm. I got serious after he died, so he didn't know that. I never thought I was going to do music before he died.
Yeah.
And my mom, she was always supportive of what I wanted, always.
How old were you when you left Spain?
Let me think about it. Okay. I was 1728.
28.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's how old I was when I moved here, too. So at 28, your career is going well in Spain. Mm-hmm. You're playing in festivals, getting good press. And there's a part of you that's thinking, what, if I'm going to go to New York, I should go now, don't wait longer? Or what brought you here?
I came to New York a couple of times before I moved here. Yeah. I came once for like 1 week or 2 weeks. I took a few lessons somewhere and I didn't like it. It was too much for me, yeah. You know. And then I came another time with a couple of friends, musicians. Yeah. They were coming for 3 months and I was like coming only for 1 month and a half. But yeah. I ended up staying 3 months yeah. with them. Fell in love like crazy with the city. I was obsessed with coming to live here. The thing is, like, it took me a little bit of years to come here because I didn't want to come without anything, you know, like nothing and no money, no savings, yeah. you know. I applied for the Fulbright to be able to study here, meet people, and also the Fulbright gives you money and a stipend yeah. every year. Whatever,
and you got month. A Fulbright?
I got a Fulbright, yeah.
So you went home and you did the work to figure out how you could come here.
Yes, yeah. And but I was literally obsessed. I knew that I needed to come here to live, you know.
What did you recognize that you needed from this, do you think? What was it? That
I feel for me, personal happiness always comes from growing, you know, and somehow.
From
like,
growing?
Yeah, like spiritually, you know, musically, yeah. anything. And I felt like this city was so challenging that I will be able to develop way more if I will come here. And also it was like so many stimulations, and also I'm always like escaping the routine, even though I love routine,
yeah.
but knowing what is going to happen, you know, and I kind of like felt that if I stay in Madrid, I knew what was going to happen, you know, and also it could get a little bit better, but it was going to be more or less that my life, and here anything could happen, and I still feel that anything can happen.
Yeah.
You get stimulation from people, you meet people from all over the world, people from every culture. You meet all your heroes, you know, and you can access to them. You can play with them and things like that.
It's incredible, that access. It was very scary to me, that access, for a long time.
Yeah, for me too. You're like, take a little bit of like a step a little bit closer. Yeah. What happened? And then you are getting closer.
And then you're there, and then you're inside of it.
Yeah.
You moved in 2011. By 2015, you were making records, but there's 4 years where you're developing your community, your
well, I was studying. Yeah. I did my master at NYU. When you are in school, you don't have like a lot of time for anything else. Yeah. I was meeting people and writing music and everything.
I guess going to school was helpful to give you a community of people to be around.
Exactly. That's exactly the idea why I wanted to ask for a grant and go to school. Because I know it's hard in New York for people that come without anything to create a community and your friends. And some of my best friends are still the people that I met at NYU.
Yeah.
But you spend a lot of time together, and that you don't have that kind of time as soon as you need to start working.
That's right. No, you don't. Did you feel your creative approach change when you got here? Did you feel your music change?
Oh, yeah. It changed a lot. I mean, it changed. There is something always in common that stays always there, you know, but then like it has been changing all the time.
Was there ever a fear that you have so much influence that's coming that you lose yourself? That you're absorbing so much that you sort of forget what parts you actually want.
Yeah. No, I never had that fear.
Yeah.
No.
Yeah.
No, because in the end, I mean, I think it's kind of impossible to forget yourself, you know?
Yeah.
Also, if you are honest when you write music or you are honest when you play music, it's impossible to forget yourself. You always like process everything through yourself. Yeah.
So I listened to your new record, Perpetual Void. Mm-hmm. I listened to Perpetual Void, and I didn't know anything about this story. I've heard some of your other records. I heard your last record, and I've heard you play. And I felt from the very beginning of listening to this new music that I was listening to somebody going through something, like processing an emotional period in their life.
Yeah.
It just felt like there were a lot of emotions happening. And then I read the story in the liner notes about the record, and I discovered that, in fact, this project was actually the result of you processing something.
Yeah, it was like an emotionally intense period for me, you know, because I deal with mental health things that I never had. And I was scared. It's super scary, you know, because you talk about it from outside and you think, oh, well, whatever, like meditate or whatever. When your mind controls your body and you feel like in an emptiness there, you know, and you don't know how to control that, and you don't see the light, and you don't see the future, and you don't see. It's like super scary, and That's, I think that's the reflection. Because the other record was different because it was a little bit like my mom, you know, dying and everything, you know.
The last record, not to skip it, because I think it's actually tied to the conversation about leaving Madrid and coming here, which is very forward-looking, like to leave Madrid to come to New York and pursue your music and be surrounded by all of this is about growth and development. But one of the potential hazards of that is that you can find yourself isolated from your family. And when COVID came, you couldn't go back to Spain and your mother passed away during COVID. And so the previous record was kind of about processing that.
Yes. And the pandemic and everything. Yeah. I feel like everything that happened to us during the pandemic, it was like kind of magnified, right? And like when talking about feelings and whatever, and a lot of things happening, personal things and feelings and relationships and everything, you know, that they were magnified. But this is different because I was like talking about just my mental health problems and everything. It was a dark period.
It started with insomnia?
I mean, it was everything tight, you know. I had anxiety, and that the anxiety made me like not be able to sleep. And I would fall asleep, no problem, because I was exhausted. Mm-hmm. But I would wake up at 3 in the morning, 4, you know, and my mind was going crazy. It was impossible. Not even like trying to sleep, I couldn't even lie down in bed. It was
I couldn't be.
Yeah, it was like impossible for me to lie down. Sometimes it was so intense that I had to get out like at 4 in the morning and go for a bike ride or something because I couldn't be at home. I couldn't, if someone would have explained to me, I wouldn't have been able to understand before it happened to me, you know, because it's like hard to explain, I feel, if you never had that. Thank God now it doesn't happen and I'm totally fine and I'm totally cool. And it seems like something that I can't even like understand myself because it's not, but it happened for a long time, you know, for 2 years or 2 years, 2 years and a half or something like that.
And were the majority of these compositions written in that time?
Yeah, I think all of them.
I read an interview that you did in Downbeat maybe 5 years ago where you were asked about some of your song titles and you said, song titles are really often, they happen after the fact, they're arbitrary, you need to put a title to a song, and so you look around the room and you see dead flowers or you see light coming through the window. But the song titles on this record...
Yeah, this is different because when I write this song, it's how I'm feeling, you know. I remember when I wrote The Absence of the People, I was in Madrid and I was like in one of my worst periods. I was having a really hard time and obviously I couldn't sleep. I was in an apartment. I rent an apartment from a friend that it was a little bit dark. I was by myself. I was like feeling like I needed the people closer to me, you know. And so
you named the song The Absence of the People You Long For.
Because that was the feeling that it was impregnated. That was like, you know, over there in that period of time where I was like writing that song, you know. Not that because the song, it was especially about that, but because that was like my feeling when I wrote the song. You know?
So what about the song, I Don't Want to Live the Wrong Life and Then Die?
Actually, that title comes from a novel. It comes from a novel, but I watched the TV show. Uh-huh. Called Station 11, and they say that. But it's exactly how I felt during all this period, you know, when I was like with my mental health issues and whatever. One of the things that I will feel, and my mind will go crazy in a tunnel of like obsessing about like wasting time and like really be careful about my choice and like, you know, I have one life and I need to, you know, do whatever, you know, like the right choices to have the life that I want. And
then,
you know, like it was like, but in a crazy, bad way and, you know, dark way, you know. But so when they say that in the TV show, I relate. I mean, everybody relates, even people that is happy. When I say it in a concert or whatever, I was like, yeah, me neither.
But I, you know, it's funny that you say even people that are happy because I mean, whenever I see you socially, you smile and you have a happy energy. But then when I read about some of the stuff that you've gone through and how it plays in your music and even how tortured some of the music is, that there's a sense of real longing and search. I thought, don't judge a book by its cover always, because you seem so light to me when we meet, but I don't think you are so light.
Yeah,
actually.
No, I'm not very light. My internal world is a little bit heavy, but at the same time, it's like I enjoy, you know, when I'm like in a social context and seeing people, you know, I enjoy the connection with people. For me, it's one of the most important things in life. And I guess if I'm present there with that, I don't carry all the emotional baggage that I come with me.
Yeah.
That counts more like when I by myself or, you know, in certain moments, you know.
Yes.
But also I feel like in a social context, if I'm present with the people, I'm present with the people and I enjoy that. And I also have a very positive life size on me, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm not bringing like my tormented internal war there, you know.
Yeah, well, thank you for not bringing in. But it's interesting that both can be true. I mean, in fact, I think that's a big part of what you are kind of arguing in your music also, is that both can be true.
Yeah.
You know, your music is doing multiple things at once. It can both.
I would say more. I feel like it cannot be like real beauty and real deep beauty if you don't have the opposite. I feel like you need both sides, you know. They complement each other, and to get deep into something, you have to get deep into the other
opposite.
Part. When my father died, I got also like into a real dark period without really even realizing. I realized later. I was 16, but I started like drinking so much and doing drugs and kind of like hurting myself without realizing. I thought I was partying and having fun, but then like when you look back. But then like when you find these people that had this similar experience, you connect in a way, in a deep way, in a beautiful way that you can connect with other people, you know? And that's, I don't know, that's kind of like beautiful. I feel like we experiment that make us like wanted the other thing, the opposite thing in the same deep way, you know?
There is no pleasure without pain. There's no light without dark. There's so there's no beauty without whatever the opposite of beauty is, ugliness.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I think so.
And I think in some of your writing, particularly on this record, maybe because you have to tell most of the story with the piano as opposed to writing for horns, which is what you've done in the past, it's difficult sometimes to understand what elements are compositional and what elements are performed or improvised.
That's like my dream. Thanks for saying that.
Oh, good. That's the dream, that you're not sure where is the composition and where is it. So tell me about that.
My ideal, in an ideal world, I would love to play a composition, and I understand improvisation like a development of the, like something that emerges from the composition and develops the composition in a way, you know. That for me is the ideal of the improvisation, not like playing like a song and then like start improvising something.
Right, I finished playing the melody.
Yeah,
now I'm gonna, now here's my solo, and then we go back to the melody.
Exactly.
But I think that you, at least in the way you're organizing your own writing on this project, that is happening.
Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome. I mean, it seems so clear to me though. Like I think that you are achieving what you're going for. How important do you think it is, not only to the listener, but to you, to share what you're going through?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's not that important because I feel like everything is in the music, and I wish people don't need to hear the words, just listen to the music. And like the other day, we played yesterday this music in a theater, and someone was crying, you know, told me that she was crying, and then someone told me that, like, it was so emotional, it has so much emotion, the music, that's what I want, and the music in itself. But I just feel that people want a story and want to know what is behind the record, you know? So if they are going to ask me, I'm just like,
here you go.
Trying to go be honest, you know, and be vulnerable, because otherwise why you're gonna even do it, you know?
You know, when you were talking earlier about how that you see more young women in jazz today because they had role models, you know, the obvious logical extension of that is, so you have become one of those role models.
Yeah, for me it's hard to see because I like feel I have so much to learn yet, and I like, you know, you never feel like, how can I be a role model? You know? Mostly people from Spain, a lot of like young women actually brought me and told me that, and I have a woman also that is doing her PhD, and she's doing about me, you know, and she tells me how much inspired her, and she wanna be, you know, like she wanna do what I'm doing, and like, and she's talking a lot about that, about being a woman and how it's important for her that I'm doing what I'm doing. And I have another friend, Rosa, that we became friends, that she takes lessons with me, and she, same thing. And some people contact me and told me that, but it's hard for me to see.
You start to become known as somebody who came here and then did this. And so even though you think, why am I a role model? What I'm still trying to, but I think it starts to really represent something larger.
No. I realize, and I'm happy that this is inspiring for someone. And I always encourage everybody to do it. Also, to be honest with you, I'm like, why? But then I think about it, and it's like, I understand because I was in that position.
And if you are a role model as a jazz musician, a Spanish jazz musician, a female Spanish jazz musician, are you also thinking there's a responsibility to talk about whether it's mental health or processing grief, or that in a way that is a way to be a kind of role model?
Yeah, I feel like yes. I mean, everybody that knows me knows that for good and for bad too, I'm a very honest person, you know. Yeah. And I don't see the value of saying something or painting a story that is not true, because people go through that. And for me, it was super, super helpful to, when I went through that, then read stories of people that was going through the same, and they had the same symptoms and whatever. It was a relief, you know, because it was like, okay, there's so many people doing that, and there is ways to, you know. And
but so did you, are you diagnosed with something? Or
no, I was like, I had anxiety, whatever. But even though they gave me like pills and whatever, I never took pills. I decided not to take pills. My doctor gave me pills. My therapist told me, don't take pills because you're not going to solve the problem, you know.
Interesting.
You know. But if you are really bad, and I remember once that I was like, I'm going to take the pill, and then magically, I got way better, you know, so it was like kind of like, okay, that's a sign.
Do you think that these challenges that you've faced have been necessary for you as an artist? Like, do you think you could just be...
I mean, I don't know if necessary, but for sure, everything that you go through helps. And yes, I feel like I actually grow a lot as a musician during the pandemic and during all this period, in many sense, you know, and always everything you go through and you have to overcome always makes you, you know, grow in somehow. And if you're an artist, that's going to reflect on your...
But do you think if you woke up one day and you said, you know, I just feel satisfied?
No, I don't think that's going to happen.
I think
that's
fortunately,
not possible.
Fortunately for the music, that is not going to happen. So. In order to set up this interview, we had to coordinate between schedules, and yours was quite busy. And I realized that your life, you know, we don't know what people's lives are, what they're doing to make a living, what the fullness of your career is. But I know that you were coming from teaching.
Yeah, I mean, actually not teaching a lot right now because like I'm going to be traveling basically, going in and out until July I cannot be present in the Brooklyn Conservatory. So I have set, a few private students, you know, but not that many. I also do like tracks for our company that plays them in Spotify, tracks of like meditation. Or, like,
wait, you do tracks for a company of meditation music on Spotify?
It's not only meditation. I do also jazz tracks and that, but we record these ones and then I do some tracks for different playlists. Wait, they want you to compose thinking of placing them in a playlist, you know. So they are like, I do for different playlists. I mean, my name is not there. I use a fake name for sure.
Amazing. Wait, I have so many questions about this, and it actually reminds me to tell you that one thought I had listening to this new record, and I imagine if I listened to all your records, I'd feel the same way. But this one particularly felt like the score, the soundtrack to a movie that has not yet been made, the movie of your mind.
Probably the other ones even more. Everybody say that my music has a lot of like visual aspects, but you know that I studied to be a film director.
Yes, this is what I want to ask you about. So while you were at Conservatory in Madrid, you were also studying cinema.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
To be a film director.
A film director, yeah. That's what I wanted to do.
What do you think are the similarities between being a film director and being a musician or a composer?
I mean, you're telling a story somehow, like one is more abstract. I mean, even like when you tell a specific story in a movie, you in the end, you are like telling an abstract, you know, behind an abstract story, right? But you're creating something that carries an emotion, you know, and I'm telling something. I mean, it's like creating anything. I feel like everything is related, anything, whatever you are creating, a painting, a movie. To be honest with you, I love cinema and I love creating with the light. The only reason I decided to do music is because to be a film director, you need like to convince people to get money. Then like You write a script, then like if you get the money, it's a lot of people involved, and then you start filming, and then you like, you know, it's like a lot of process, and then after 2-3 years, I don't know, 4 years, it takes a long time. Then
maybe it doesn't happen.
Yeah, no, so maybe even if it happens and whatever, then the scripts and the final result, also there are a lot of like things involved, you know, even when I did some short films, and
yeah,
like there's a lot of people involved, and some of the people don't have the same idea, and then the thing like goes deviate, and oh, you don't have time when it's raining, you cannot like film these things as you, and then the thing is like not even like, it can be like far away from whatever you envision and you wanted to tell, and it's like after all the effort and all the time, and you like so much time with this project, when you for probably your mind after the second year is in another place, you don't want to be doing that. And music is just, you just call your friends and you play music in the moment. You don't need any money. You know, you can create in the moment and create, you know. So it felt like more like easy and real and more like connected with yourself all the time.
But maybe you brought some of your cinematic approach.
I'm sure. To your music. I'm sure. Yeah.
Do you think you'll ever go back to Spain?
I don't see myself going back to Spain, but who knows, you know? Who knows?
You know, when we were talking about the role model aspect of being, I suppose the other side of that is that you also, you know, there are these bands that are all women, or they're, you know, and it's like at a certain point you kind of want to move beyond that as well.
Yeah.
Was there ever a part of you that sort of thought, like, I don't want to... Like, Melissa Aldana, I spoke to Melissa Aldana last year, and she said to me, I don't want anybody ever to think that I'm a woman when they watch me play or hear me play. I don't want that to be on their mind at all.
Yeah.
I just want them to hear my playing.
Exactly. No, I always felt like that.
Yeah.
My whole life, I felt like that. And I feel like that exactly the same.
Yeah.
And also, I always say, people say, like, oh, I can feel that you're like, when you play, I can feel, you know, your feminine energy. And I always say, everybody is like, man, like, there's no difference on the playing of a woman and a man. There's not, you know, that just doesn't exist, you know, it's not real. If we look at history, the woman that like has been like the playing is very strong. I mean, Jerry Allen or Mary Lou Williams, or like, like, very, it's not like feminine and delicate, how people describe it. I also hate the festivals that are only for women, or the bands that are only for women, and everything. It's like, I feel like the whole point of like creating this movement is like to create a scene that is like balanced, and that everybody's integrated. All the genders are like it's a reflection of the society, whatever it is, you know, like know that we are like separating from the rest, you know, creating something else.
And what about your understanding and relationship with Hispanic and Latino culture?
Mm-hmm.
When you arrive in the United States, you kind of begin to belong to a group of people that are connected through language and a kind of a, ultimately in real terms, a kind of colonial past with one another.
Yes.
But once you're here, you become part of a common culture.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, when I came here, I was kind of like, well, you're like including me in this Latino thing, but my culture is totally different to them. You know, we are not part of that. We are like more like Europeans. But then actually I have to say that once that I spend more time here, I totally identify as Latino, because it's like also I connect with the people as you say, because of the language and whatever, in a special way. And the culture is the same also.
Yeah.
Like we don't have we have a lot of things that are like culturally the same. So when I'm like with my friends, Chilean friends, Argentinians or whatever, like I feel like a Latino, you know, I feel like part of that Latin culture, yes.
So in the end, you discovered that part of yours. Because I think it's true, like theoretically, you should be hanging with Italians and French people. You have as much in common with them as you do with, or Portuguese people.
But again, the language, you know, the language, and becoming another person in another language is like your old self when you're speaking Spanish, you know? So you just like more... You also, I mean, it's a more developed human being somehow, the one that is speaking in Spanish, because it has been speaking in Spanish for a longer time, you know?
That's true.
And he learned everything well in Spanish when we were kids and everything. And, you know?
There's also a sense, though, that you learn who you are in your home language, and then you've discovered this version of yourself here.
Yeah.
And then you enter a space in which neither one is fully and authentically, truly who you are. You live in this middle space.
Yeah.
right?
Yeah, that's very true. Yeah, that's very true.
And it's like there's never one place that will ever satisfy all of your needs.
That's true. That's very true. Yes. Yes, that's true. And also with the language, you realize that sometimes you're speaking in Spanish or you're speaking, and then you say something in English because there is no word in Spanish. So an expression is like, I want to say that. I don't know how to say it in Spanish. There is no way to say it in Spanish. Yeah. You know, it's like this image that you can express in your own language. It's not there, you know.
Did you come to feel that there was a particularly American way of playing the music?
For sure, there is like, I don't know if like an American, you know, but I guess an American, but more authentic way of playing that what we think in Europe, even though you are like careful to really listen to this music whatever. And but also I feel we are like a little bit lost on whatever, what is, no, because we always listen to Miles and Country and whatever, but from the things that are happening right now, like, you know, like, getting like stuck with things that maybe I don't think they are that important right now, you know, and they are not, you know.
Like you're saying, outside of the States, outside of
New York. Yes, when I was in Spain, yeah. Like, and I feel like I see it on the European musicians in most, it's a generalization, not everybody, you know, but I see that. I see that. Yeah, there is an affinity also. Like, I don't know if I like talking about race, but there is an affinity in Europe for white musicians, you know, instead of like going to black musicians where like, because this is a black music, you know, and I feel a lot of Europeans like lose that when it's like the important, when it's like the esteem of the music, you know. I don't know if it, because affinity or whatever it is, but
it's at the root of the music.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, and at the same time, you know, the one thing I think about, I don't know what my feeling is. I think it's as is true in your music and in your emotional life also that many things are true at the same time. Like I grew up not in New York. I told you this last time we talked also. I grew up, I'm not from Spain. I have no Spanish family at all. I just love Spain. But I grew up in the middle of the States in Wisconsin. And they were not New York. I mean, the musicians there were clearly not listening exclusively to what was happening in New York. In a way, they were more interested in, maybe it was smaller, you know, they were interested in each other and influencing each other. And, and I thought that was really beautiful. And when I went to Spain also, like...
Yes, that happens in Spain, No, and also I'm super influenced by Spanish musicians, you know, like Perico, Javier Colina, or Ariel Bringer, with whom I play, you know, a lot, and Legrón or whatever, that it, also happens.
It's kind of amazing when everybody is dealing with the same influences on some level. Mm. You know, if you play bass in Spain, you have to deal with Javier Colina. Later on, you don't have to play like him, but you will definitely know him, you know? And like the, so this is dangerous. Like suddenly in the 1990s, every bass player was like kind of playing like Carlos Benavent, you know, a little bit. They had to kind of confront that.
Yeah, that's true.
But it's sort of interesting when you have.
It's interesting, but you know what happened in Spain? That also people come from when the Cubans came, bunch of Cubans came, it was like really fresh because they brought totally a different point of view because they didn't know. All these influences, you know, and they came from Cuba. And it was great. You know, it brought a lot of life to the scene, you know.
I agree. But all that is to say, we're dealing with, these are very small groups of people as opposed to New York and the United States.
I mean, we are talking that the scene, we are talking that the scene, you know, everybody, like, it's like 30 people, you know, the whole scene.
Yeah, but there's, that's... kind of cool, you know, and, as opposed to this, which is so open. And
it's kind of cool, but at the same time, it's like... It's missing a lot. And also there is like, you know, when there is like very little people that are like some preconceived ideas and what is good, what is bad. And if someone has a lot of power or if someone knows a little bit more and whatever, like it's kind of like everybody has some idea because he imposed that idea on everybody, you know. And that's dangerous. I think as much as I love Bob Sanz, for example, in Madrid, he has been also like a great mentor for a lot of people in Madrid, you know, and including myself, you know. But he has a clear idea what jazz should be, you know, and because he has so much influence and mentorship over a lot of people. It was like kind of like what everybody thought.
Like the Winton of
Twicka. Exactly. And everybody would think that until the Cubans came and challenged that concept, you know, and they wouldn't agree. They didn't care because they respect Bob, but it wasn't their mentor, you know, and they came with other ideas, and that was great, you know, because gave a space to way more like original music and, you know, more like contemporary and, you know.
Something else I have seen in those smaller scenes, and definitely in Spain, and I think on the one hand it's really good, and on the other hand I think it can only happen in spaces where there are fewer musicians, is that some musicians become very, very expensive and very difficult to work with, or not work with, but to just to arrange. I suppose in New York, musicians can be very, very expensive also, but I've just had some experiences in smaller communities where I realize the reason this is happening is because you're the only one that can, you're one of four people that can do this.
Yes. Yeah.
So of course you ask for what you're worth because, you know, because you know you can get it.
That's true. Yeah.
And it's humbling for no matter who you are in New York to have to just deal with the fact that, like, if you can't do this gig, somebody else can do this gig.
And probably someone else can do it better than you. Unless you are like so, you know, your personality is so strong, which there are like very few of them.
Yeah. I've wanted to talk to you in this context for a long time and hear more about your story. Congratulations on your new record.
Thank you so much. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
It was so nice.
And thank you for your honesty and your openness about where your life and your music overlap.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. O sea, que no eres español. Yo pensé que eras español.
No, lo hablamos la última vez. No.
Ya, pero yo es que yo no tengo memoria.
Ya te veo. There they were, my friends, Aaron Parks and Marta Sanchez. What a beautiful way to close the season. I'll kick off 2025 back at Winter Jazz Fest this year on January 9th, 10th, and 11th. I'll be conducting interviews at the Moxie Hotel on the Lower East Side of New York and streaming them from 3 to 5 Eastern each of those days. Thank you for being part of the Third Story community. This year, here's to more stories, more music, and more connection in the year ahead. I'll be back again in your headspace with another deep dive before you know it. Until then, I'll talk to you soon.
This has been a WBGO Studios production. To learn more about WBGO Studios' award-winning podcasts, special concerts, live streams, and more, visit wbgo.org/studios.